Let's talk now about one of the most important single elements in successful selling in tough markets, and that is beating the competition. Today, competition emerges in every large sale and in many small ones as well, and your success depends upon your ability to sell against and beat the competition. You've got to expect competition. You've got to be ready for competition. You've got to be positioned for competition. You have to have a strategy and a plan to beat the competition. To be in a position to compete effectively, you must have already done several things that we've talked about in previous sessions. You must have positioned yourself in these ways. First of all, you must have specialized. There's very little success in sales for generalists today. You must have specialized with regard to your product or service. You must know it inside and out, intimately. You must know everything that it can do and can't do and the various ways it can be applied to help your customer achieve his goals or resolve his problems or satisfy his needs. You must have specialized with regard to the type of industries that you sell to. You must have specialized with regard to the function within those industries that your product or service can most help. You must really know your business, like a medical specialist, like a consultant, like a lawyer who specializes in a particular category of law. Second, you must have built your database on your customers. You must have asked a lot of questions, filled out your forms, analyzed it, thought, spoken to a lot of people, and built up your knowledge on how your individual customer functions, what his problems or concerns are, how he or she is different from anybody else that you've sold to. This, by the way, can be one of the greatest competitive advantages that you have, is that you understand and know your customer better than anyone else. The third thing you must have already done is you must have penetrated to the final decision makers. You must be speaking to the people or who have spoken to the people who can say yes to your proposal. They must have evaluated your proposal and they must like you and be satisfied with you and believe that you're acting in their best interests. The fourth thing that you have to have done by now is you must have positioned yourself and your company. By positioning yourself, we mean that you must have built trust and rapport and credibility. Your prospect must like you and believe in you and be prepared to rely on you to fulfill your promises. With regard to positioning your company, your prospect must feel that your company is reliable and respected and successful. You know that 80% of a sale can be based upon the good reputation that your customer perceives that your company has in the marketplace. The fifth thing you must have done is you must have uncovered the specific needs, problems, and dissatisfactions that your product or service can solve for this customer. You and the customer must both be clear that needs exist and that the customer needs to take some step, some action, and pay some amount of money to satisfy these needs or resolve these problems. Sixth, you must have convinced them of their need for what you sell. They must recognize that your product or service is the type of solution that they're looking for. They have to be able to see the situation clearly, and they have to see how your product or service will fill the gap between where they are and where they want to be. Seven, you must have quantified your solution. You must have written it down and shown the price and shown the value and shown the return on investment. And wherever possible, you must show that based on the savings in time and money and reduced costs and increased revenues and better sales and so on, that your product or service might even work out to be free with a profit over time. Number eight, you must have demonstrated your capability, your professionalism, your skill, your knowledge and background in this industry. It must be clear to your customer that you and your company are well suited to provide the products or services that the customer needs at a reasonable price. Once you've done all this, you haven't made the sale. Once you've done all this, you've gotten into the finals. Now, the real selling work begins. Often, just when you think you're ready to wrap up the deal, competition emerges. Why does competition emerge? Well, it emerges to lower risk. Remember, the customer is terrified of making a mistake. The customer begins to stall because the customer doesn't want to make the mistakes he or she has made in the past. He or she doesn't want to pay too much money or get an inappropriate product or get something that doesn't work or get stuck with something that is wrong for them or that they can't get repaired or serviced. The customer always wants to make the best decision, and they want to make the best decision aside and apart from you and what you need and what you want. So the customer stalls and says, let me think it over. Leave it with me for now. Let me review these details. Let me discuss it with someone else. We need a little while. I need to get the approval of some other people or the input of some other people and so on. And what they do is they start to put you off a little bit. What do these sayings mean or these expressions mean? They mean, by the customer, I want a lower risk. I want to feel comfortable. I want to be sure that I'm doing the right thing. So they delay the decision to get more information, just to assure themselves and other people that they're making the right decision. Remember, we said that risk is a factor of four things. First is the size of sale. Remember, we said that wherever there's a large sale, wherever there's a lot of money involved, risk is a critical factor because people don't like to part from large amounts of money. It makes them very nervous and tense and insecure. A second factor that determines risk is the number of people involved. If many people will be involved or affected or are in a position to approve or disapprove or their work will be changed or disrupted by buying this particular product or service, there's a very high element of risk of making a mistake. The third element that contributes to risk is the life of the product. If they're buying a product or service from you that locks them in for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, and they can't get out of it except at high expense, that denotes a certain amount of risk. And the fourth element that creates risk is whether or not the customer is a first-time buyer, whether or not they have ever bought this product before so that they're familiar or unfamiliar with it, or whether they have ever bought this product or service from you. In either case, risk comes to the forefront. Risk becomes the preoccupation, and everything that they do internally is to find ways to reduce the element of risk and raise the element of comfort. You have to assume at this point that they want the benefits of the product or service that you sell. The only question is, can you overcome the fears that they have at this point? And one of the ways that they help to overcome their own fears is by inviting competition to come in and give them different viewpoints, different options, and different prices. The customer wants to expand his or her variety of choices to be sure that he or she is making the best decision. Almost everybody, when they go shopping, looks at two or three or four different suppliers for a particular product or service. If you're buying a car, the average number of dealerships visited by a new car buyer is 10. From those 10, the new car buyer will reduce the number to about 3 or 4 and then make a choice from those 3 or 4. And the reason for this is because nobody wants to feel that they've paid too much or they've left money on the table or they haven't gotten something that they could have got if they had been a little bit more patient and explored a few more options. The customer wants to assure that your price is fair. He or she wants to know that the amount that you're charging is the right amount to charge him or her. Remember, customers aren't so much concerned about getting the lowest price. Most customers know that the lowest price goes along with the lowest quality. What they're concerned about is that the price is fair. Customers hate to find out afterwards that they paid more than they had to for a particular product or service, or they could have got the same thing for less somewhere else. Another reason why competition is invited into a sale is to increase the acceptability of the decision to other people. You see, everybody is very sensitive to the approval and respect of others, especially their superiors, especially the people who determine their career path. And if they're going to recommend a decision, they want to be sure that they have enough information to be able to justify that their decision is a good decision so that others will approve of the process they've gone through and will respect them afterwards. So, as a result of all these, time is asked for. Competitive bids and proposals and presentations are solicited. Competitive salespeople are invited in to talk about their products or services, and the comparison process begins. Your goal in selling against competition is to become the preferred solution. Just to become the solution that inches out the competition at the finish line, you don't have to be vastly better or different or vastly cheaper. You just have to be a little tiny bit better to get the order. You want to end up being the best choice overall. You want to convince the customer that you are the lowest risk, easiest person, most appropriate supplier to deal with. Now, the key to winning in competitive sales are the reasons why the customer is going to make the sale. These are called the decision criteria. These are the features and benefits that the customer will use and compare against each other in choosing one product or service over another. Every decision-making process, including a purchasing process, has four steps. Every decision that you make when you're comparing one thing against another has the same four steps as well. All decisions are based on these four steps, consciously or unconsciously. First, you determine the decision criteria, or the customer determines the decision criteria. On what basis are they going to make this decision? If you're looking for a house, or a car, or a computer system, or a printing press, you go through this and you say, what are the things that I absolutely must have? What are the things that I care about? What are the things that I want to be included in this product or service? Second, once you've listed the decision criteria, you organize them by importance. You say, of all these things, which is the first most important? Which is the second most important? Which is the third most important? And so on. There is a law of four that applies to decision criteria. It says that major decisions are usually based on four different items. Of the four different items, one will be a major item, the critical determinant, often the hot button, and there will be three minor items. Now, there may be 10 or 20 features of your product or service, but ultimately the decision will boil down to usually not more than four key items. Your job is to figure out which ones they are. The third thing that you do in making a decision is you compare the various products or services or choices available against the decision criteria that you've identified and organized in order of importance to see which one stacks up best against what you want from this decision. And finally, the fourth step is that you make a decision based on this analysis and take action on what you feel is the best choice overall. You know, by the way, that you can never get the perfect choice, but you can get the choice that on balance is better than any of the other choices available. Your job with regard to decision criteria and your customer is first of all to clarify. Help the customer to define and organize the decision criteria. One of the things that you must pretend that you're doing is, imagine you're going to go back to the office and you're going to say, I'm working with this customer. And your boss is going to ask you, well, what are his or her decision criteria? On what basis is he or she going to make this decision? You should be able to answer that question. And the way that you answer that question and simultaneously position yourself as a consultant with the customer is to ask the customer these questions and help the customer to think through what exactly is important to him or her in the sale. The second thing you want to do is you want to influence the customer's thinking and have the customer place more emphasis on the decision criteria where your product or service is strong. You see, by getting the customer to focus more on what it is that you do better than anyone else, the customer is more likely to move your decision criteria to the top of his or her ranking in comparing you with others. Your third job with regard to decision criteria is to maximize and emphasize your strong points, your competitive advantages, your unique selling propositions. Your job is to make them central to the decision in the mind and heart of the customer. And your fourth job with regard to decision criteria is to minimize your weak areas, to minimize their unique selling propositions, to minimize your competitors' competitive advantages. Make them peripheral to the decision. Here is a very important statement that you can use in the course of a sales presentation. Toward the end, after you've gone through your decision criteria analysis, you say, Mr. Prospect, whatever you do, your main consideration in this decision should be, and then you insert the area of competitive advantage or the strength that your product or service has that no other product or service can compare against. Those are the words. Mr. Prospect, there's a lot involved here, but your main consideration should be. Now, it's very interesting because if the prospect accepts your advice and makes a note that his or her main consideration should be this particular feature in which you're particularly strong When your prospect talks to your competitors, your prospect will always be grading your competitors down and grading you up if he or she accepts that this should be his or her main consideration. In competitive analysis, remember that you are very much like a general on the battlefield. You need to know everything possible about the enemy. You need to get the facts and get the real facts. You need to think them through. You need to be prepared. You need to be ready. You need to know that you're going to get competition. You need to have a pretty good idea of who is going to compete with you with this type of customer at this type of price level with this type of product or service. And you need to be prepared in advance. The first question you want to ask is, who is your competition? Make a list of all the companies that you're competing against in the marketplace. And especially you want to know who is your competition in this account. And by the way, don't ever be afraid to ask. You can say to the customer, who am I up against? Who else are you considering? Who else are you looking at? In many cases, your customer will tell you. And then you could also ask, what is it about their offering that particularly appeals to you? You can say, you know, they're a very fine company and they've been in business for a long time. These are kind of innocuous comments. Can you tell me what is it that they're offering that you like? And if there's something that they have that you like better than what I have, could you tell me what it is? You have to know what you're up against. So you ask, who is your competition? And you also ask, what is your competition? You see, your competition may not just be another company that sells an identical product or service. In each sale, your competition may be other uses of the money. The company has only a certain amount of money, and they may be looking at going several ways. And your job is maybe to show them that expenditure of that amount of money on your product or service is a better use of the money than anything else. It may not be a competitive product at all. It also may be ignorance. Very often, the greatest single block to your making a sale is that your customer is ignorant of how much better off he or she could be with your product or service. And that goes back to what we've talked about earlier. Another question is, why do customers buy from your competition? The starting point of beating your competition is to respect your competition. Poor salespeople dismiss their competition or criticize their competition or badmouth their competition. But intelligent salespeople, successful salespeople, respect their competition and they examine their competition and study their competition and they ask their customers, why is it that you have bought from our competition? What particular benefits do you perceive that you get from our competition that you don't perceive you get somewhere else? Find out what the customer's perception is, because perception or positioning in the customer's mind is the customer's reality. And if you want to get that sale from that customer, you've got to change or influence the way he thinks and feels about his existing supplier. You should ask also, what are your competitive advantages? Think through, what is it that you, your company, your product or service does better than any other company in the marketplace? Be very, very clear about it so that you could be woken up in the middle of the night and you'd be able to answer clearly in 25 words or less why it is that a company should buy from you rather than someone else. Then ask, what are their competitive advantages? What are their competitive advantages? What is it that your competitor has or does that makes him or her or his or her products better and superior to yours in particular areas? Be very honest about this, because being honest about where your competitor is better than you is the starting point of defeating your competitor on the battlefield of sales. With the answers to these questions, make a list of your best selling points. Write them down on paper in a column down the left-hand page. Then organize the list by value and strength. Make another list and say, this is my strongest feature. This is my second strongest feature. This is my third strongest feature. Then select your three toughest competitors, the competitors that you seem to run into more than anyone else, the very best people in your industry, and also analyze their selling points by comparing them with your selling points. Where are they stronger than you? Where are they weaker than you? Then give them a scale from 1 to 10. Give yourself a scale from 1 to 10. Double-check this scale with other people to see that they agree with you. And then finally, decide your competitive strategy. Now you know the correlation of forces. You know your enemy's strengths and weaknesses. You know the terrain. You know how it's laid out. Determine how you can position or deploy your troops against your competitors in such a way that you can win the battle. There are 7 non-price determinants of every sale. Your job as you move into the final part of the sale is to emphasize the non-price determinants of the sale, the variables that you can offer that are not associated with price, so that you don't get into a price argument at the end. The first of the non-price variables is the quality of your product. But quality doesn't mean that it's the best in the world. Quality means suitability. It means appropriateness for what the customer needs at this time. If quality was the key, then everybody would buy Rolls-Royces instead of Hyundais and Hondas. The fact is that quality is always defined by the customer's needs and his or her capacity to pay and his or her situation at this time. Quality is defined by the Crosby Quality Institute as conformance to customer needs or conformance to standards. Your job is to find out exactly what the customer needs at this time and in this place, and to show him or her that your product or service exactly fills those needs, is the most appropriate. That constitutes quality. The second non-price variable is delivery. When your delivery is fast, dependable, and predictable, it makes your product or service more valuable. Many sales are made to particular companies because they are more dependable and they give faster and more consistent delivery than other companies. A perfect example of this is Federal Express. Federal Express has a reputation for virtually perfect on-time overnight delivery of packages and services, and it's built a multi-billion-dollar worldwide business by being fast, dependable, and predictable. The third non-price variable is installation. If your company will install the product or service, this gives the customer a higher level of security, a feeling that everything will be okay, that it's a safe decision to go ahead. It reduces the amount of worry. It saves the customer time. In fact, a promise of very careful, fastidious, accurate, guaranteed installation can sometimes be the critical factor that gets you the sale and enables you to charge more than your competitor who may simply drop off the product and rely on the customer to install it. The fourth non-price variable is the terms. What is your down payment? What is the trade-in value that you give for previous equipment? What interest rates do you charge? How do you do your billing? In many cases, a company can outsell their competition by offering better terms, by offering internal financing, by offering no down payment, by offering higher trade-ins or longer payment schedules, by offering lower interest rates, or by offering a form of billing that is more convenient for the customer. The fifth non-price variable are the services that you offer after the sale. Your perceived level of helpfulness, the speed at which you'll respond to your customer's needs, the responsiveness of your company when your customer has a complaint or a concern. These, by the way, are the critical factors in determining photocopier sales, in determining hundreds of millions of dollars worth of photocopier sales, where all else is fairly equal. It is the customer's confidence in your level of service that makes the difference. The sixth non-price variable is follow-up support, which equates to trouble-free ownership. A perfect example of this is Lexus or Infiniti, which rank number 1 and number 2 in the J.D. Power customer satisfaction surveys. Why is this? It's because they guarantee 50,000-mile, 5-year, bumper-to-bumper, complete warranty on the entire car, and if the car needs to be serviced, they will send someone out with a new Infiniti or Lexus for you to drive. They'll take the car back and service it and deliver it to where you are living or working at the time. If the car breaks down anywhere, you have special numbers that will put you straight into a telephone bank and get a tow truck out to you almost immediately. So the confidence that customers have that they'll never be stuck once they buy one of these cars leads to them being 2 of the most successful luxury cars sold in America. The 7th non-price variable is the reputation of your company, its public image, the respect and admiration that other people have for it. This translates into a high level of confidence. This lowers risk. This makes the customer feel happy and proud that he or she has decided to buy from you. In fact, IBM in their heyday used to run an ad in the purchasing journals, and it said nobody ever got fired for specifying IBM products. So if you went to your manager and you said that you were going to recommend IBM, you would almost always be respected for the quality of your decision because IBM was so respected during its heyday. Now here's an important point. Price is usually not an effective differentiator in a large sale. Of course, you can't be two or three times the cost of your competitor, but focusing your arguments on the attractiveness of your price relative to your competitor will usually not get you the sale. Every single study that has been done on price, even with customers who say that price is terribly important to them, finds that customers rank price number 6 or number 7 out of 6 or 7 buying criteria. Price very seldom ever ranks high in the determining factor. However, if you ask salespeople almost invariably say customers are totally preoccupied about price. Price is the main thing. It is almost invariably the salesperson who makes price the issue by talking about it, by justifying it, by arguing it, by using comparisons, by trying to explain why theirs is better than their competitors at lower prices and so on. But top salespeople, when customers complain about the price, they say, yes, it does seem to be a little bit more expensive, but you get a lot more for the small difference in price. So let me explain why. And they then go back into talking about non-price differentiators. In competitive strategy and positioning, now that you've done everything else we've talked about, when you've determined the decision criteria, this is what you do. First, you focus and emphasize where you are strong in terms of the customer's decision criteria, in terms of what the customer really wants and needs to get from this decision. Second, you downplay or minimize where you're weak or where you're vulnerable. You point out that this is really not that important or not that significant with regard to making this kind of a purchase. Here's an example. A company is making a presentation for a complete installation of computer equipment and peripherals. The key decision maker says, well, wait a minute, I think we're going to buy from a large national company because they have service departments throughout the country to service our products, and you're only a local company. The smart salesperson for the local company asks this question. Tell me, sir, do you have divisions and offices throughout the country? Well, no, I don't. We're based right here. Well, then, paying extra for a product with peripherals for service installations throughout the country would not help you. In fact, it would be much to your advantage to buy from us rather than from a larger company, because to us, you represent a much larger percentage of our total business, which means that we will give you much more attentive service. And we're local, so that we can service you immediately, whereas a larger company will feel that you are only a small part of their business, and they'll service you when they can get around to you. In other words, you can show that where the customer thinks you're weak, you're actually much stronger, and where the customer thinks your competitor is strong, it may not be a strength at all. There are three things that Neil Rackham recommends in his books on spin selling and large account selling to deal with areas of decision criteria where you may be a little bit weak. The first are what he calls overtaking, which is to simply show that your decision criteria should be moved up the list of importance that your customer has formed. Show that your decision criteria, where you're strong, is actually more important than the customer realized. Second is redefining. Show that your decision criteria, even though it doesn't look as good as your competitors, is actually better because of a particular reason. And find a creative way to show that even though your machine may not produce as many units per hour as your competitors, your machine has a far lower level of breakdown and maintenance time, so therefore your machine operates more hours per month and produces more widgets or units overall. So therefore, even though it's slower, it's actually better. And the third is trading off. Show that your product or service is the best choice, all things considered. you can show that, sure, the competitor has an advantage here and a benefit there that is superior to yours, but on balance, your total package is superior to that of your competitor. Once you've presented your arguments, ask your customer for his feelings, his opinions, his feedback. Here's a great question. You say, Mr. Prospect, no product is perfect, including this one. Can you tell me some of the weaknesses or shortcomings that you see in my product? And then remain silent. You see, by doing this, you'll uncover objections or concerns or doubts that the customer may have in his or her mind. You'll get your customer to tell you the areas of weakness that you're going to have to compensate for in order to get the sale. Never attack your competition when you're going up against them. Never even mention them if you can possibly avoid it. If your competitor says, well, we're looking at ABC Company, you can say, well, ABC is a good company and they've been in business for a long time. However, we've been growing more rapidly than they have for several reasons that you may be interested in learning about. And go on to talk about your product or service and why it's better. Never say that theirs is bad. In fact, if you can avoid mentioning their products or services, it's much better. Instead of talking about them directly, you could point out the relative strengths and weaknesses of your approach to solving this problem versus their approach, your design versus their design, your philosophy in developing your business and your products and services versus their philosophy, and even the emphasis that you put on in your business versus the emphasis that they put on. When you have weaknesses in your product, be sure to point them out, and then show how your strengths outweigh them. Say, you know, our product is not perfect. It's not as strong as it could be in this area, but these are the offsetting or compensating factors that we've built into it that really makes this weakness irrelevant. Present first the problem or weakness, and then the solution or the strength that you have. And here's the key. If you know you're going up against competition, and you must assume that you are, be sure to tell your prospect the weaknesses in your product or service before your competitor does. If your competitor points out that there's a weakness or a problem with your company or product or service or people, and your competitor points it out before you do, your customer may feel that you were trying to deceive him, that you were trying to lie by omission, that you were trying to pull the wool over his eyes. And customers are terrified of being taken advantage of. Remember, as we've said throughout this program, the level of trust that you build and maintain at all costs is the glue that holds the sale and the relationship together. Throughout the sale, continually focus on the customer. Focus on his situation. Focus on his problem. Focus on his needs, his concerns, rather than you and your company and your product or service and your features. A good exercise is to imagine that there is a spotlight on a swivel between you and the customer. And each time you're talking to the customer about him and his needs and his problems and his concerns, the spotlight is on the customer. As soon as you start talking about yourself and your product or service and why you're good and why you're better, the spotlight is on you. Your job is to keep the spotlight on the customer. Show that your product or service is the ideal solution. Match your product or service to his problems and needs and goals exactly, and demonstrate that on balance, you are the best choice over all the choices available. In selling against competition, be patient, low-key, and low-pressure. Don't get excited. Develop an attitude of calm, confident expectation, and practice gentle persistence. Keep nudging the sale forward, and never let any statement by your competition or by your customer about your competition put you off. Just keep smiling, concentrate on the relationship, ask questions, listen, and focus on the customer. And bit by bit, little by little, you'll win the competition and come out ahead. We're going to talk now about one of the most important and most ignored areas of professional selling. And it is the subject of power, politics, and influence in the major sale, and in the minor sale as well. If you think that politics only takes place in government, I can assure you that even when you are selling to an individual in a home, and there's a husband and wife and perhaps a couple of children involved, there is a tremendous amount of political pressure one way or the other to help you or hurt you in the sale. And everything counts. In a simple sale, you only need one call on one person to get one decision to buy one product or service, and you never have to see or talk to the customer again. As we mentioned earlier, this is the AIDA model, which stands for attention, interest, desire, and action. And once you get action, once you close the sale, you're gone. However, today in complex sales, you usually have to make several calls, and there are several decision makers, some of which, many of which, you never even meet. Because you don't meet the final decision makers, or because there are several people whose opinions will come together to make the final decision, it changes your entire approach and methodology. You have to sell differently from the get-go. From the very first contact with the customer, you have to be aware that many different people are going to have inputs determining whether or not you're successful in this account. Power, politics, and influence determine all large, important, expensive sales today. Now, we know that the top 10% of salespeople are very sensitive to power relationships. They're like long-tailed cats in a room full of rocking chairs. They are alert and sensitive and watching and paying attention to the actions and interactions of people all the time they're with the customer. They take the time to understand the power relationships before they try to make a sale. Often, their competitive advantage personally is their knowledge of how decisions are made by their customers. It's their knowledge of how the customer goes about making a particular buying decision and how they can help to influence that decision. There are politics in every organization, and politics can be healthy or unhealthy. Healthy politics seem to be aimed at the best interests of the organization. Healthy politics are where the individual concerned is jockeying and using their power and influence and strength in order to get things done in the best interests of the overall company, in order to reduce its costs, protect its reputation, increase its profitability, and so on. Unhealthy politics, which seem to be the case in larger organizations, tend to be aimed at the personal benefit of the individual, the self-aggrandizement, the promotion, the additional money, the strength relative to competitors within the same organization. They tend to be negative politics that aim at undermining or undercutting competitors, colleagues, peers, and superiors. This type of politics also exists in many companies, and you have to be sensitive to it and aware of it. But in either case, whether you're dealing with healthy politics or unhealthy politics, the political situation in a company is a given as far as you're concerned. You must work within it. You don't try to change it. You don't try to alter it. You don't try to get into the game of it. You just simply accept it for what it is, understand it, and work within it to get the buying decisions that you want. Now, political power is sought and it's used for several things. Its first use, of course, is for influence over the use of money and other resources. Political power in companies is used for control and the direction of activities. It's used for control over individuals and people, their roles and responsibilities, their activities and the way they spend their time. Power is also used to satisfy ego needs. Power can be emotional. It can be used to gain respect and promotion and recognition and rewards. In fact, power just for its own sake is a strong drive in many people, especially men, and many sales are stalled, delayed, derailed, or directed to competitors for no other reason than that someone wasn't asked their opinion before the decision was made. Be very careful about rushing decisions in companies before key players can put their two cents worth in. The relative power of decision makers in an organization determines the purchase decisions. You need to ask questions to find out exactly how the structure works and exactly how you have to position yourself and your product or service. Here's some of the questions you can ask. You can say, "Tell me, how is this sort of decision made around here?" Or, "If you bought this sort of thing in the past, who made the final decision in the past?" Or, "How was that decision made?" Finding out the process of decision-making in the past is very helpful, although it doesn't guarantee that this is the way the decision will be made in your case. A good question to ask is, who are the key decision-makers in this area? Or, how do they decide between this and something else? What are their major areas of concern? What are they trying to accomplish? What are their responsibilities and positions? Where are they in the corporate hierarchy? And here's another good question is, in addition to yourself, Bill or Susan, is there anyone else who will be involved in this decision? People are very reluctant, as we said earlier, to tell you that they don't have the power to make the decision all by themselves. But if you ask them, in addition to yourself, is there anyone else who will be involved? They'll often say, well, yes, in addition to myself, there's my boss and my boss's boss and the chairman and the board and so on. It doesn't matter who it is or what it is. You've got to know who else is going to have an influence in saying yes or no. Power is the ability to influence decisions more than anything else. And in a sale, there's usually only one person who can give you a final yes. There are many people who can give you partial yeses. They can give you little yeses, if you like, but there's only one person who can put the final stamp of approval on the sale. Many times as salespeople, we make the mistake of thinking that we've made a presentation to someone who says, I like it, we should have it, we want it, the price is reasonable, it's better than your competitors, and we think we've made the sale, only to come back and find out that this person is only one step on the ladder, but this person is not the key or the final decision maker. In every sale, there are also many minor decision makers. These are people who can say no. And one of these people saying no can very often sidetrack the sale or delay it or terminate it altogether. Finally, there are peripheral decision makers. These are people who don't have a lot to do with the sale, but they have ego involvement, they have power needs, they want to feel important and to look important. And although they won't even use your product or service, they will use their power to delay a decision, to flex their muscles, to show that they're a force to be reckoned with. And often they'll say, well, why don't we put off this decision till the next quarter? And you know as well as I know that the longer a decision is delayed, the less likely it is that it will ever go through. Your job in dealing with power and politics in organizations, your first job, is to build a wide network of contacts in customer organizations. And again, we talked about this earlier. Ask questions of a variety of people. Listen, double check. When you talk to one person, ask for permission to speak to his or her subordinates or to his or her peers. Ask for introductions to other people and say, well, you're talking to them about this product or service, and I just wanted to get your feelings and your opinion on the appropriateness of this product or service for this company. So asking for people's opinions, asking for their feelings, asking for their viewpoints will often give you an opportunity to say, oh, that's interesting. How do they make that sort of decision around here? Or who are the key decision makers in that area? Or how have these decisions been made in the past? Sometimes your ability to get a purchase approved for someone in the organization is a key political skill, which makes you more valuable to the customer you're dealing with, even if it's someone above that customer who is the final decision maker. You can become more valuable both internally and externally by developing the capability of knowing how to make a sale within a large company, especially against competition. As you begin to develop your network of contacts within an organization, it's essential that you think about and identify the various types of power. Many people think that power is all the same, but there are many different forms of power, and each of them are different in that they have different ways of influencing people, different concerns, different priorities, different values. Some are intensely involved in the decision, and some are only peripherally involved or don't even care at all. Here are some of the different kinds of power that exist in any organization and in almost any large buying decision. The first is position power. Position power is the most common. This is usually indicated by the title of the person, the president, the vice president, the controller, the general manager, the senior administrator, or so on. Many people feel that the ability to make the final decisions flows to the person with the highest title, but this is very seldom the case. People who are at the top of the corporate hierarchy, those with the highest titles, are often thought to be the people who make the critical decisions. But in reality, they learned over time that it's much better to push the decision-making down closer to the level where the decision is going to be effective rather than to make it themselves. Many salespeople make the mistake of attempting to get appointments with the key people in the company only to find that the sale stops at that point and nothing else happens. Because these people are not the ones who even think about the product or service. Those decisions are made further down. I'm the president of my own company, for example, and I make very few major decisions that affect the operations of my company. All the decisions with regard to computers, telecommunication systems, office equipment and supplies, much of the advertising, printing, manufacturing facilities, and so on, all of these decisions are made by other people in the company. I stay out of them. I will sometimes comment or observe or ask questions, but basically, since I don't want to be caught up in the day-to-day cut and thrust of those decisions, I stay out of the decisions from the beginning. Many senior people don't get involved in major decisions, and many salespeople sink their chances of even selling in a particular account by starting too high up. Remember, the person that you want to talk to is the person with the problem, the person who needs the solution to affect their individual work or their individual position. You don't want to go to people who are way above it or way below it. The second type of power in an organization is the financial power. The financial power is the person who really processes the money, controls the money. These are the accountants, these are the controllers, the vice presidents of finance. These people are very bottom-line oriented. They're not so concerned with what your product or service is. They're concerned with what it costs and whether it's a low-risk, no-risk decision. Their orientation is toward accuracy and inexpensiveness, to letting go of as little money as possible. Their tendency is toward delaying decisions on products or services until they can get more and more information to give them a greater and greater assurance that this is the very best and finest price that they can get for a particular level of product or service quality. Their concern is almost invariably the return on investment that your product or service represents versus your competitors. They continually compare you with others on the basis of very small elements, and especially on the basis of very small increments of price. The third type of power is the user power. This is the person who will have to use the product or service day in and day out. Their primary concern is how easy it is to use, how effective they will be, how much more productive they will be as a result of using it, and how much better they will look in the eyes of their employers and their senior people. These are invariably staff people. These people cannot say yes to a major purchase, but they can sure say no if they don't feel it will be right for them. They can also encourage the critical decision maker by being enthusiastic about installing your product or service. So take time to talk to the people who will actually have their hands on your product on a day-to-day basis. The fourth type of power is the technical power. This is the person who passes judgment on whether or not the product is suitable for their company, whether or not it fits into the way they do things, whether or not it is consistent with existing machinery, existing equipment, existing systems, and existing ways of doing business. The person with technical power cannot necessarily say yes, but he or she can certainly say no. You must sit down with this person and talk to them and find out what they want and what their concerns are. And sometimes very small adjustments in your product or service offering will satisfy them completely. The fifth type of power is expert power. This is often called ascribed power. This may not even be a person who uses your product or service, but it is a person who is highly respected for their knowledge or their skill or their authority or their performance within the business. Their opinion is highly valued by other people in the company. For example, the top salesperson in an organization often has expert or ascribed power. He or she may not even be interested in your product or service, but people will ask him or her because he or she is a key person or a key player in the business game. The expert in a company may also be an outside person. It may be a consultant. It may be an advisor. It may be someone who's working with the company on a contract basis who has a lot of knowledge about how your product or service has worked in other organizations. If there is an expert, again, talk to the person, find out their concerns, find out what they want to accomplish, find out what their agenda is. Sometimes just being a likable person, being a nice person, getting along well with a prospective decision maker or power is all that you have to do. At the very worst, and they say this in politics, sometimes the people who get elected are the ones with the fewest enemies. At the very worst, you don't want to have any enemies at any level of the company. You want everyone to be, at the very worst, neutral toward you and your recommendations. The sixth type of power is the mentor power. This is the coach or the helper in the client account. This is the person who wants you to be successful making the sale. This person wants to be liked and wants to be respected for having been the contributing force to getting your product or service approved. This person you must have in every account, and this person acts as your advisor. Very often he or she can be one of the other powers as well, but this is the person who will guide you to do and say the right things and will introduce you to the right people to move the sale forward. The seventh type of power in each account is what is called the vendor champion power. This is the person who champions you and wants you to make the sale. They want to help you in every way possible. The vendor champion may be the same as the mentor power or the coach, and it may be someone different. This is the key to the sale, by the way. You have to have someone in the company who wants you to be successful and who is in a position of power and authority to guide you, to act as a blocker for you, to open up opportunities for you, and to get you meetings with key people. If you don't have someone in the company who wants you to be successful selling, it's going to be very, very hard for you to make any progress. The eighth type of power is the customer champion. This is a person inside or outside the company who wants the company to buy the product. This represents pull-through. Just like the vendor champion and the mentor represents push-through, this represents pull-through. This is the person inside pulling the rope hand over hand that wants to get you and your product into the company. And it's very important that you have someone like this. The ninth form of power is called outside powers. These are people outside the company or organization who are relied upon for advice. And very often, critical corporate decisions are determined by the opinion of a person that someone in the company knows outside the company altogether. Every salesperson who's been selling for any period of time has lost a sale because of a consultant or a friend or colleague or relative of a key person in the company recommended against it at a weekend golf game or barbecue. Some of the other outside powers are lawyers and accountants and other professionals. They may be other vendors or suppliers of different products or services, and they may even be competitors who have very good relationships inside the company. These people have power because they can influence the allocation of resources and the making of decisions. Anybody who can have any influence over the buying decision must be viewed by you as a power, and at the very least, they must be neutralized. And at the very best, they must be brought over onto your side and made to be supportive of your recommendation. The tenth form of power is called the alternate solutions power. These are other uses of the same money. These are very subtle, but very often a company will not buy because they feel they can use the money that your product or service would cost better doing something else. Sometimes it will be a different product or service. Sometimes it will be a competitor's product or service. Sometimes it will be an expenditure on something that is completely unrelated to what you're talking about. Your job throughout, of course, is to convince the prospect that the very best allocation of their limited funds would be on your product or service. The most important power of all that you can develop yourself is personal power. This is developing your power, your authority, as an expert, as an ideal person to do business with, because you really seem to know and understand the business and the industry. Personal power is based on three things. It's based, first of all, on your knowledge of the industry. The more you know about the customer's industry overall, the more of a specialist you are, and the more you'll be respected for your advice, and the more your advice will take precedence over the advice of other people in the company who have lower levels of expertise. The second form of personal power is your knowledge of this specific customer's situation, problems, needs. The time that you've spent to really understand this customer and to make recommendations that dovetail exactly with what the customer needs at this time gives you a tremendous amount of power. And the third form of power is the quality of the relationship that you form with the various decision makers, the level of trust you have, the level of credibility that you've established, and especially your likability. Remember, people are emotional. They like to buy from people they like. And if they really like you, it will overcome many, many smaller details that would knock another competitor out of the box. The key to likability is the friendship factor. And the friendship factor is based on time, caring, and respect. The more time you invest with a customer, the more they will like you, and usually the more you'll like them. The more you demonstrate that you care about the customer and his or her situation by asking good questions, by listening attentively, by making good recommendations, the more the customer feels that you care, the more the customer will be attracted to dealing with you. And finally, respect. By being polite and courteous and respectful with everyone you deal with, you'll build up a fountainhead of strong positive emotions that will cause people throughout the company to want to deal with you. You must take time to learn and understand and consider the power relationships in every organization and the percentages of influence held by each person, both inside and outside the company, and how to position yourself among them. There's no substitute in large sales for personal contacts, for continuous questioning, and for homework. Present your product or service to each person, each source of power or influence, in terms of both how the company will benefit and how the individual will benefit from having this product or service installed. Think carefully. Think through in advance. Never antagonize anyone. Always be positive. Always be pleasant with whoever you deal with. Politics in every company is a game. It's an unavoidable game. It's a fact of life like the weather. Your job is to learn how it works with your particular customers and to focus your efforts on your main centers of influence. Focus your efforts on those people who have more power in the aggregate than many other people put together. Be patient in developing your contacts and your network. Bide your time and move only when the forces are in your favor. The final point with regard to power, politics, and influence has to do when you can't get to see the final decision maker personally, when no matter what you do, the person says, well, give me the information, I'll take it to the decision maker, I'll take it upstairs, I'll take it to the committee, I'll take it to the board. I've spoken to countless salespeople who've asked me in great frustration, what do you do when you can't get through to talk to the final decision maker personally and you have to get someone in the company to make the presentation for you? Well, what you do is you do it well. You see, the person who is going to make the presentation for you is called your ball carrier. This is the person you're going to hand off the ball to, and they're going to run for a touchdown. This is your sales rep in the sale. It's almost like a junior rep of yours. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking that if you give your material to someone, they're going to take it upstairs and do a bang-up job presenting it. Always ask this question when the prospect says, well, I have to take it to the committee or I have to take it to my boss personally. You ask this. You say, tell me, Bill or Susan, if this was your decision to make, what would you do? and sit quietly and wait. The only answer that's acceptable would be is, if this were my decision, I'd buy it right now. I really like it. In other words, you want your ball carrier to be very enthusiastic about taking this product or service upstairs and recommending it for purchase. What we know is that in a company, the boss's attitude toward the employee has far greater influence than the very best relationship that you could ever establish. If your ball carrier takes it to his or her superior or the committee, and they say, what are you bringing us this for? We're not really interested at this time. They'd say, okay. And they would come back to you and say, look, you know, I did my best, but they've got a lot of things on their plate and so on. In other words, they won't make any presentation at all. So here's what you do. You say, well, if you're going to represent this product or service to the committee or to your boss, let's talk about how you might go about it. And then you train and coach and prepare your representative, your ball carrier, to make a good presentation on your behalf. You present the pros and cons. You know, they may ask this and they may ask that, so you have to be prepared. You show the strengths and weaknesses of your product or service. You help go over the possible questions and answers that the person he's taking the recommendation to may ask. And you fully prepare and rehearse, almost like a person who's going to be a stand-in for you in a stage play. You fully rehearse this person so that when they do go to make a presentation, they have all the answers that the committee or the boss will ask. Remember, the critical factor in modern selling today is risk. You must focus on demonstrating at every stage and with every power in the organization that your product is the best choice, lowest risk solution to a particular problem. Your job is to answer the question, why should the company buy this product from you? Why should they choose you over their competitors? Throughout the sale, from your very first contact and for as long as you work in that account, you must be extremely sensitive to the relative power and influence of various people and how the power and influence changes over time, and you must establish relationships with every key person who can have an effect on saying yes or no to your offering.